Today I'll be reading John 2, verses 1 through 5. You can find this on page 978 in your Shed Bible. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana, Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." This is the word of the Lord.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'd like to be welcome. Who doesn't want to be welcome? Welcome is good.
Everybody, I would love to introduce you to our teacher, Meredith. Meredith was here yesterday to help guide parents through the parent symposium. And just a couple of days ago, she was in California. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Remember when we talked on the phone this week and you said, "What's the weather like?" I said, "It was nice."
You're like, "It's going to be fine. It's
it
great."
It was nice.
Yeah.
On that day. It was nice.
Yeah.
And here we go. Welcome to Michigan.
It's real cute, this thing.
Very cute. Thank you. Yeah. Meredith and I and Chad Thorson, we were at a conference together. I don't know, recently.
Like last week.
Yeah, last week.
Something like that.
And I will say, we unexpectedly got to hang out for multiple hours.
Which was very fun.
And it was... no offense to the conference. That might have been the highlight of the conference for me, was being able to spend time with you.
You don't want to be in like a pseudo-academic, like children's ministry focused, very intense 12-hour day? That's like not your jam?
I really liked hanging out with you. And I'm really glad you're here today. So
Thank you.
I just wanted to give a Singiva Marso welcome to Meredith Miller as she teaches this morning.
Thank you so much. I am just so, so grateful, so delighted to be with you all. Snow aside, I don't understand it. So here's what happened. I lived in Chicago for 5 years and did 5 winters. And then I came home to Southern California and promptly blocked it all out, right? Like, so I do still own my boots, but my kids for a couple years got pet rats because you give your children weird things because you like them. And then the rats, oh darn, they ate my winter coat. And I just let that go and figured I don't need one ever again. And I'm okay with that. I love Southern California. It is a really great place to call home. And I live about 30 minutes, give or take, from this really great park that has been part of our family's story, like even since I was little. Like I think I went there for the first time when I was like 2. It has been this place that we go as a family to reconnect. It's been a place we've gone in hard seasons. It's been a place that's actually been important in like healing in some important ways in my story. And it's a place we go for celebrations. It kind of does all of these things. I was there last Monday with my mom and we spent some time together. Flight's willing. I'm going tomorrow with my kids. And I actually do happen to have a picture from one of the times that we were there together. Now I know you may not know LA all that well, but I think maybe you know this one. Now, in stark contrast, I can remember a time a few years ago when we were living in Chicago, and it was winter, but I don't think it's winter's fault. Although maybe, okay, well, I don't think it was winter's fault, but I was sitting in my therapist's office, and I had a big old pillow hugged against me, and I was talking to her about stuff, and I just said to her, "I have a complicated relationship with happy." Because I do. I have a complicated relationship with happy. Happy felt selfish, like overindulgent. But I was in a time when the lack of play in my life, it wasn't just kind of hurting me and bringing me down. Not having things in my life that were playful and fun was actually taking a toll on my trust in God as well. I'm kind of wired up to work real hard and get things just right. And I was at this point where I was like, I don't want to anymore. And the question that I wanted to open up that day when I said I had a complicated relationship with happy was it maybe just possible that God didn't want me to either? That maybe God actually wanted me to find fun things as much as I wanted to find fun things, that maybe God wanted to help me uncomplicate happy. I just find it curious how growing up sort of coincides with losing our capacity for delight and for wonder. Right? I had the joy of being able to sing right here, and whoever's guy was doing the circles, I was like, man, that turn radius with your ankles and knees, you got it going on still, kid. And then I watched someone from an older generation take notice of his circles too and smile at him, because that is what we do with our children in worship together. When they worship as children, different than us, they have this way of knowing it's not that complicated. And I kind of find myself thinking about that unselfconscious ability to enjoy play and not feel guilty. And I wonder where that goes. And I would imagine that if you are interested in psychology, you psychologists out there, you could probably give a more complete answer about the ways that we are a culture that socializes away joy. If you're a church historian type who loves to look at the way that Christians have dealt with this topic, there are probably some insights you could offer about the way Western sensibilities about things like holiness and the way that word gets used and then misused, it's kind of squashed the fun out of life. For me, I'm convinced that part of it is about this pervasive myth that joy is beside the point of Christianity because of obedience. And I think that the story we're going to explore today can help with that. But what I mean by this myth is it's this idea that, for instance, the story we just read about this wedding, that the point of the story stops right at where the reading stopped today. Do whatever Jesus says. And we go, okay, I will. And we do that as best we can, even if it seems to be making us miserable, which is odd because that doesn't seem like what Jesus offered. But we get all tripped up thinking that joy is beside the point of faith because obedience is the point of faith. So the myth goes. And verses like Hebrews 12:11, they say things that also complicate this, I think. Hebrews 12:11 says, for the moment, all discipline seems not to be pleasant, but painful. Yet to those who've been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And so we hear that and we're like, yeah, fun is not the point of discipleship. Fun is a selfish pursuit and it undermines the more spiritual one. We are supposed to suffer, not have fun. We're supposed to be holy, not happy. So the myth goes. I mean, look no further than the heated debate as to whether it is appropriate for Christians to dance. I grew up Baptist. This was the conversation. I went to a college where we allowed dancing. We hosted dances. We had a great time. But I didn't even realize when I went off to my Christian college that there were like much holier Christian colleges that do not allow dancing. And that's how they let you know that they're holier, by making sure that you know that they don't allow dancing. And then they would like side-eye, like if you'd say like, oh, I go to this school, and they're like, oh, you don't really love Jesus then. Okay, it's fine. Okay. But the Bible, unlike those Christians, it doesn't present a contrast between long-term formation and joy. In fact, throughout scripture, joy is an essential component of our formation. Joy is an essential component of salvation. It is part of the fruit of the Spirit as God works in us, right alongside patience and peace and all these other attributes that sometimes get elevated as actually better. Paul, writing to the Philippians, reminds them to rejoice in God always. And not only is he saying to rejoice as if it bubbles up from within us, there's kind of this fun twist to the verb that invites us into collective celebration, like celebrate in the Lord together. That however this rejoicing happens, it's actually shared, communal, and practiced. When the prophets in the Old Testament paint this picture of a future day when God is going to come and act and save Israel, usher in a glorious kingdom of God, one of the most common ways the prophets describe that reality is that it will be joyful. Because our God is a joyful God. And just like it takes practice to connect to God's peace or God's patience, it takes practice, I'd say, to connect to God's joy. And there's a part of us like, nah, what do you mean it takes practice? Maybe. Like, how could the practice of joy be one of those disciplines that might seem unpleasant at the time? This is the fun one, right? But can I ask, have you ever experienced some sort of negative script that just won't stop running a loop in your head? Have you ever been caught in something that mentally is just looping you around and around and you can't shake it? And more than that, have you ever been stuck in the time where you can't shake it and you're not even totally sure you want to? Sometimes complaining and letting off steam through complaint feels like the only outlet we have to cope with the stress. And so even though we can recognize the negative loop, we're actually not so sure we want to let it go. When I was a young mom and my kids, who are now 10 and 12, they were like 2 and 4. And we had a stretch where we could not get out the door on time to save our ever-loving lives. Like, house could have been on fire. We weren't going to make it out the door on time. Wasn't going to happen. And my sweet kids are trying to get themselves out the door. And I'm sure, again, this is the season of life where we lived there. It was winter. I think it was winter's fault. The boots and the coats. It all comes back to that. I don't understand y'all's weather. But we're rushing. And I'm like, okay, guys, come on, let's go. And I'm trying to have my like cheerful parent voice. Everybody out the door. Here we go. We could do it. But like the more mornings happen, the more it's like, everybody out the door. Let's go. And then it becomes at times, oh my goodness, you are the reason we are not getting out the door. Hurry up and put on your shoes. And we're running the loop. And that venting becomes the easiest way to let that go, and we're stuck. And joyful mornings as a family feel completely unrealistic. The blame script felt easier than trying to actually practice joy. I think there are times that anxiety can almost feel like an easier place to stay because it's what we know, even as we can see that it's not doing us well. And joy feels like a pretty challenging thing to practice. But it's practice that's worthwhile because our God is a joyful God. Now, as a kid, I was around a lot of golf. My dad was a golfer. He was decent as a golfer. And I went to golf camp when I was in sixth grade. And so I got to golf a lot. I really mainly just like driving the golf cart. Like that's actually the part that was best. And so I would love to borrow an image from golf to help walk us through what's going on here a little bit more. And if you are not a golfer, I promise it will still make sense. All right, so we have a golf course here. When you get up to the tee box to start your hole of golf, which is the part where you hit the ball for the first time, the first thing you actually do is look out at the hole ahead, and you are looking for hazards. You're watching down to see where the hazards are. There are two types of hazards in golf. I told you, if you don't know, we're really going to make sure you're with us. There's water and there's sand. You would like your little ball to not go in the water or the sand. That's really ideal. And so you watch out for hazards. Even if you know next to zero about golf, you can imagine it's basically really unhelpful to a game where the purpose is to move the tiny ball from one spot to another if the ball gets stuck underneath the water or in a pit of sand. And so if this golf hole could be a bit of a metaphor for us today, I would venture that there are hazards, two of them, that get in between us and a little bit more joy. And the first is the trap of idolizing happiness so that it, not following Jesus, becomes the point of religion. The trap of idolizing happiness so that it becomes the point rather than following Jesus. A lot of my work over the last 20 years has been related to young people and the way that they get to know God and the way that they grow in faith. And part of that has included some research on young people in faith formation. And what happened out of this research project was that students who were raised in youth group started into their adult life, and they started talking about like how they understand God and what they think God's like and how their views of God have changed. And as these young people start describing their faith, a term emerged. The researchers at Notre Dame were actually the ones to coin this, Christian Smith. He said that basically most young people all believe the same thing, no matter what religious tradition they came from. They all tend to subscribe to something he called, and this is going to be a quick test of how much coffee you've had this morning, moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic, the point is to be good. Therapeutic, religion is there to make me feel good, to feel happy. Deism, which is a view of God where God just sort of like watches you, kind of like Santa Claus, deciding if you've been bad or good. But that God can pop in to make sure things don't go wrong and to keep you happy, because after all, being happy is the point. And the way this works fundamentally is that kids who are raised in this system believe that all you're really supposed to do is learn two lists really well. First list, what are the things that good Christians do? Second list, what are the things that good Christians do not do, like dance? And once you get these lists down, then you do those things, and that's the point. So all that stuff that good Christians do, where they read their Bible and they come to church and they da-da-da-da-da-da, we got all that locked in, and then all the stuff that we do not do, and depending on what tradition you come from, that looks like all sorts of details. These two lists sort of function as the basis of their faith. But they manage those lists because they are sure that if they do, God will keep them happy. That's the therapeutic piece. And that fundamentally ends up meaning that happy is the point, not Jesus. Happy is the promise, not the presence of God with them. And the challenge, of course, with that is that life gets hard. And pain comes for everyone. And then the whole thing breaks down pretty fast. Now, if the first trap is the one that idolizes happiness and makes happy the point, the second trap is the trap of despondency, where we look out at the injustice and the suffering in the world, and we think that joy is actually pretty inappropriate if anyone really cares about this stuff. In light of the world's pain, in light of everything we just prayed for right before we started exploring scripture together, how can a person celebrate? SNAP benefits are suspended and you're going to Disneyland tomorrow? Seriously? How dare you? Fun is selfish. It shows you aren't serious about the things that need to be addressed because they matter to the heart of God. And instead, this trap reasons, we should commit ourselves to what I'm going to call do-goodery. It is the tireless devotion to tackling systemic change. Do-goodery, even when the good is important, even when the goals are worthy, it's still a form of managing the lists of the stuff we're supposed to do. It's just different lists, like making sure you recycle all your personal plastics and you never wear fast fashion and you don't buy anything from Amazon, or at least if you do, you just feel really guilty about it. It's still lists. Other moralistic systems might build the lists around personal morality, like honesty or responsibility, but do-goodery and tirelessly chasing down systemic change with nothing else happening in your life or soul, it's still a list management system, and it still breaks down. Because the thing is that God's joy renews the justice-loving, righteousness-seeking people of God. so that the pursuit of that justice and the pursuit of changing those systems and the pursuit of making wrong things right is still done in ways that are life-giving and joy-filled, even while it's essential and serious work, because the thing we're working for when we see that justice realized is still joy-filled. What I want for my neighbor that I know and that I don't is not just that the things that are systemically causing them harm would stop, but that then they would get to have lives full of joy too. That's where we're heading together. The world God's restoring will be distinctly joyful. Anchoring to a joyful God is part of the path down the fairway, if you will. That's the short grassed part in the middle where you want your ball to go, just in case. And so we have to navigate the risks of idolizing happiness and making happiness the point instead of following Jesus, or idolizing justice seeking to a point that it becomes do-goodery and losing the connection to the joyful God who makes all of this joy-filled. Joy is a marker of the reign of God among us. It is a reality we're invited to access all the time because it matches who God is. It's a marker of God's presence, and that will take us back to our wedding. Where we left off from our reading was that point where obedience was on the line. Will they do what Jesus says? But we're going to read through the whole thing together again. So the next day, says John, there's a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee, and Jesus's mother is there, and Jesus and his disciples are also invited to the celebration, and the wine supply ran out during the festivities. And so Jesus's mother said, they have no more wine. And Jesus gets real sassy and is like, yeah, not my problem, lady. My time hasn't yet come. And his mother, for I don't know what reason, tells the servants to do whatever she says. Like, I don't know what Mary has going on in her mind there. I wonder if she thinks Jesus is going to step in or if she just wants him to be ready just in case. Standing nearby are 6 stone water jars. They're used for Jewish ceremonial washing. They hold like 20, 30 gallons apiece. Like, they're honking. Jesus told the servants, fill the jars with water. And when the jars had been filled, he says, now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies. And so the servants followed his instructions. And I wonder what's in their minds as they do. Like, we are about to get seriously fired for bringing this guy water right now. This Jesus guy is going to cost us our jobs. I don't know. But they do it, and the master of ceremony tastes the water that is now wine, not knowing where it'd come from, though, of course, the servants knew. So maybe Jesus was actually on purpose inviting the ones who were most likely to be left out to be the first ones to watch what would happen. And he says to the bridegroom who he calls over, a host always serves the best wine first, and then everyone's had a lot to drink. He brings out the less expensive wine then, but you kept the best until now. And then John closes by just saying the miraculous sign at Cana was the first time Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So John decides to put this like early in his storytelling. And John really loves to play around with how he orders the stuff that Jesus did and said. He like wants it sequenced all on purpose. And so he decides that when he wants a kickoff story to have everybody hearing what Jesus is about, he's going for this one. Of all the things he could have said about what Jesus was going to say and do, he decides the one that's going to capture the heart of it best is the one where Jesus turns water into wine so that there is so much good wine, the party is just going to keep on going. Another interesting thing I find in this story is how weddings are community events. Like, everybody's there. They are these like mini festivals that the whole community is bringing together so that they can be involved in celebration and they can be pointing to what they're supposed to be as a people. It's a little story of faithfulness every time they decide to get all those resources together for a wedding. And then if we want to nerd out about Greek for like a quick sec, the wedding event, it happens not the next day, which is sometimes how translations have it. It says the third day. And numbers are super fun in the Bible because they're often like representative of something and hardly ever literal. It's not really about calendaring things. When something happens on a third day, it's usually a sign that there's something new on the horizon. Something new. And that new thing would be that the reign of God is actually showing up and actually available. And if you want to know what it's like, look at that wedding where the guy who claims he's authority over all of this reign decided to make sure there was going to be a stinking ton of wine. There is abundance and celebration and joy marking what this is all about. And because it's a miracle story, John loves to call them signs because they point to things. This is the way he talks about all of Jesus's miracles. They point to something. Of all of the things that John could have said about why Jesus came, he chooses this. Not our obedience, our holiness, our behavior, our management of the lists, not even necessarily dealing with sin, except insofar as sin is the thing that is causing the injustice, that is creating so much suffering that Jesus wants to deal with in order that the joy would be real, in order that the wedding would feel like everyday life, in order that everyone would know they are invited, including those servants, with their jugs of water. And so he makes sure to start at the wedding because the reign of God is like a huge party for the whole community, and everyone's invited with an abundance available. I just really don't want you to miss the heart of this story. Jesus does the miracle for the purpose of keeping the party going. That is the whole reason he decides to do it. He's not having some other grander thing he wants to say, some greater purpose he wants to bring. The point of the miracle is to keep the party going. The point of the miracle is joy. The wedding's not a break before the people get back to the real work of being a holy people, because to live joyfully is to be holy. And I think we know that in a lot of ways. If holiness just means we're set apart, if it means there's a purpose that we hold on to, the point of the joy is that it is a way in which we're holy. And living now in ways that are genuinely joyful, I think we can see how that would be quite distinct from so many of the ways we're invited to live otherwise. Maybe you, like me, feel a little complicated when it comes to happiness or joy. And that might also just be because we don't think God actually delights in us. We can't really imagine a God who's fine with us just plain having a good time. But that seems to be the case here. Jesus is here to help him have a good time. Fun is the point. Because fun is a pathway to grace. Ben Patterson once said, joy is what we feel when we're grateful for the grace we've been given. Joy is what we feel when we're grateful for the grace we've been given. But I also think it works in reverse. That if we need to reconnect with a God who has grace for us in all things and invites us into that life, joy is a pretty great on-ramp to working back as well. Play can often help us get back there. We have a joyful God creating a joyful world. We are invited into joyful lives. And that is part of what brings about the reign of God for us and this world God loves. So when you came in, you grabbed bubbles. Yes? If you did not grab bubbles, now is the time to get up and grab bubbles. Y'all need some bubbles. You all need some bubbles, by the way. So if you missed bubbles, now's your moment. They're all over.
If you need multiple bubbles because you just know yourself, yeah, do that.
Good, good.
I pastor a little church where we take time every Sunday we gather for some responsive sort of space. And I think you all have similar sorts of things, but I'm hoping you'll be willing to do something that our community has done along the way and we can do together. Everyone got finding their way? Terrific. So what we're going to do is two parts. First, I have a few questions for you this morning where I would love to just give you some time quietly to think for yourself. I can go up here and I can talk for a while and make this case for our joyful God who invites us into joyful lives. And I also then want to give you some space to think about that. And then after we have some of that quiet time with some guided questions, we're going to play a little bit together. So if you haven't had a chance to get your body comfortable, feel free to fidget, adjust, settle in, take a breath. If you'd like, feel free to close your eyes, if that helps you to be able to just catch your own thoughts. And then I'd like you to think of something you love to do. I want you to think of something you love to do. If you love to read or knit or be crafty, if you love to golf or bowl or hike, just think of something you love to do. Once you've called it to mind, I'd love for you to activate your imagination. How does it smell when you do that thing? What do you see? What are the sounds around you when you're doing that thing? How does it feel? As you imagine the thing you love to do, where is Jesus? Find Jesus in your imagination as you do this thing you love. How's he looking? What's he up to? Now, if it is easy for you to find Jesus in this imaginative place, then this might be a practice you can come back to that just cultivates some more holy imagination for joy. If it is hard for you, this might just be an invitation to try right now for today and just see how it feels. It's totally fine if imaginative prayer feels like a stretch for you and if it's not really how you're wired, but maybe today just try one more time to imagine something you love and then look for Jesus. God activate our imaginations for joy. Remind us that you are a joyful God. It is part of who you are. May we let your joy fill us and fuel us. Amen. And now, if you're able and if you'd like to, would you please stand up with your bubbles? And if you're in the tech booth, would you hit it? Go.